"Wasn't what name?" asked Lucy, with her brother's head in her lap.
"Alan wasn't the name of the people Sir Harry's let to."
"Nonsense, Freddy, you know nothing about it."
"Nonsense yourself. I've this minute seen him. He said to me, 'Ahem, Honeychurch.'"
Freddy was an indifferent mimic.
"Ahem, ahem, I have at last procured really desirable tenants." I said, "Hooray, old boy," and slapped him on the back.
"Exactly, the Miss Allens."
"Rather not, more like Anderson."
"Oh, good gracious, there isn't going to be another muddle," Mrs. Honeychurch exclaimed. "Do you notice, Lucy, I'm always right. I said, don't interfere with Sissy Villa. I'm always right. I'm quite uneasy at being always right so often. It's only another muddle of Freddy's. Freddy doesn't even know the name of the people he pretends have taken it instead."
"Yes, I do. I've got it. Emerson."
"What name?"
"Emerson. I'll bet you anything you like."
"What a weathercock Sir Harry is," said Lucy quietly. "I wish I'd never bothered over it at all." Then she lay on her back and gazed at the cloudless sky. Mr. Beebe, whose opinion of her rose daily, whispered to his niece that that was the proper way to behave if any little thing went wrong. Meanwhile, the name of the new tenants had diverted Mrs. Honeychurch from the contemplation of her own abilities.
"Emerson, Freddy, do you know what Emersons they are?"
"I don't know whether they're any Emersons," retorted Freddy, who was democratic.
Like his sister, and like most young people, he was naturally attracted by the idea of equality, and the undeniable fact that there are different kinds of Emersons annoyed him beyond measure.
"I trust they are the right sort of person." "All right, Lucy." She was sitting up again. "I see you looking down your nose and thinking your mother's a snob. But there is a right sort and a wrong sort, and it's affectation to pretend there isn't."
"Emerson's a common enough name," Lucy remarked. She was gazing sideways, seated on a promontory herself. She could see the pine-clad promontories descending one beyond another into the Weald. The further one descended the garden, the more glorious was this lateral view.
"I was merely going to remark, Freddy, that I trusted they were no relations of Emerson, the philosopher, a most trying man. Pray, does that satisfy you?"
"Oh, yes," he grumbled. "And you will be satisfied, too, for they're friends of Cecil, so, elaborate irony, you and the other country families will be able to call in perfect safety."
"Cecil!" exclaimed Lucy.
"Don't be rude, dear," said his mother placidly.
"Lucy, don't screech. It's a new bad habit you're getting into." "But has Cecil—"
"Friends of Cecil's," he repeated. "And so really desirable. Ahem, Honeychurch. I've just telegraphed to them."
She got up from the grass. It was hard on Lucy. Mr. Beebe sympathised with her very much. While she believed that her snub about the Miss Allens came from Sir Harry Otway, she had borne it like a good girl. She might well screech when she heard that it came partly from her lover. Mr. Vyse was a tease. Something worse than a tease. He took a malicious pleasure in thwarting people. The clergyman, knowing this, looked at Miss Honeychurch with more than his usual kindness. When she exclaimed, "But Cecil's Emersons, they can't possibly be the same ones. There is that." He did not consider that the exclamation was strange, but saw in it an opportunity of diverting the conversation while she recovered her composure. He diverted it as follows.
"The Emersons who were at Florence, do you mean? No, I don't suppose it will prove to be them. It is probably a long cry from them to friends of Mr. Vyse's. Oh, Mrs. Honeychurch, the oddest people, the queerest people. For our part, we liked them, didn't we?" He appealed to Lucy. "There was a great scene over some violets. They picked violets and filled all the vases in the room of these very Miss Allens who have failed to come to Sissy Villa. Poor little ladies, so shocked and so pleased. It used to be one of Miss Catherine's great stories. 'My dear sister loves flowers,' it began. They found the whole room a mass of blue, vases and jugs, and the story ends with, 'so ungentlemanly and yet so beautiful.' It is all very difficult. Yes, I always connect those Florentine Emersons with violets.
Fiasco's done you this time, remarked Freddy, not seeing that his sister's face was very red. She could not recover herself. Mr. Beebe saw it and continued to divert the conversation.
These particular Emersons consisted of a father and a son. The son a goodly, if not a good, young man. Not a fool, I fancy, but very immature, pessimism, etc. Our special joy was the father. Such a sentimental darling, and people declared he had murdered his wife.
In his normal state, Mr. Beebe would never have repeated such gossip, but he was trying to shelter Lucy in her little trouble. He repeated any rubbish that came into his head.
"Murdered his wife?" said Mrs. Honeychurch. "Lucy, don't desert us. Go on playing Bumble Puppy. Really, the Pension Bertolini must have been the oddest place. That's the second murder I've heard of as being there. Whatever was Charlotte doing to stop? By the by, we really must ask Charlotte here sometime."
Mr. Beebe could recall no second murderer. He suggested that his hostess was mistaken. At the hint of opposition, she warmed. She was perfectly sure that there had been a second tourist of whom the same story had been told. The name escaped her.
What was the name? Oh, what was the name? She clasped her knees for the name. Something in Thackeray. She struck her matronly forehead. Lucy asked her brother whether Cecil was in.
"Oh, don't go," he cried, and tried to catch her by the ankles.
"I must go," she said gravely. "Don't be silly. You always overdo it when you play." As she left them, her mother's shout of, "Harris!" shivered the tranquil air and reminded her that she had told a lie and had never put it right. Such a senseless lie, too. Yet it shattered her nerves and made her connect these Emersons, friends of Cecil's, with a pair of nondescript tourists. Hitherto, truth had come to her naturally. She saw that for the future she must be more vigilant and be absolutely truthful. Well, at all events, she must not tell lies. She hurried up the garden, still flushed with shame. A word from Cecil would soothe her, she was sure.
"Cecil!"
"Hello?" he called, and leant out of the smoking-room window. He seemed in high spirits. "I was hoping you'd come. I heard you all bear-gardening, but there's better fun up here. I have won a great victory for the comic muse. George Meredith's right. The cause of comedy and the cause of truth are really the same. And I have found tenants for the distressful Sissy Villa. Don't be angry. Don't be angry. You'll forgive me when you hear it all."
He looked very attractive when his face was bright, and he dispelled her ridiculous forebodings at once.
"I've heard," she said. "Freddy has told us, naughty Cecil. I suppose I must forgive you. Just think of all the trouble I took for nothing. Certainly the Miss Allens are a little tiresome, and I'd rather have nice friends of yours, but you oughtn't to tease one so."
"Friends of mine," he laughed. "But, Lucy, the whole joke is to come. Come here."
But she remained standing where she was.
"Do you know where I met these desirable tenants? In the National Gallery, when I was up to see my mother last week."
"What an odd place to meet people," she said nervously. "I don't quite understand."
"In the Umbrian Room. Absolute strangers. They were admiring Luca Signorelli, of course, quite stupidly. However, we got talking and they refreshed me, not a little. They had been to Italy."
"But Cecil," proceeded hilariously.
"In the course of conversation, they said they wanted a country cottage. The father to live there, the son to run down for weekends. I thought, what a chance of scoring off Sir Harry. And I took their address and a London reference, found they weren't actual blackguards. It was great sport, and wrote to him making out."
"Cecil, no, it's not fair. I've probably met them before." He bore her down.
"Perfectly fair. Anything is fair that punishes a snob. That old man will do the neighbourhood a world of good. Sir Harry is too disgusting with his decayed gentlewomen. I meant to read him a lesson sometime. No, Lucy, the classes ought to mix, and before long you'll agree with me. There ought to be intermarriage, all sorts of things. I believe in democracy.
No, you don't, she snapped. You don't know what the word means.
He stared at her and felt again that she had failed to be Leonardesque.
No, you don't.
Her face was inartistic, that of a peevish virago.
It isn't fair, Cecil. I blame you. I blame you very much indeed. You had no business to undo my work about the Miss Allens and make me look ridiculous. You call it scoring off Sir Harry, but do you realise that it is all at my expense? I consider it most disloyal of you.
She left him. Temper, he thought, raising his eyebrows.
No, it was worse than temper. Snobbishness.
As long as Lucy thought that his own smart friends were supplanting the Miss Allens, she had not minded. He perceived that these new tenants might be of value educationally. He would tolerate the father and draw out the son, who was silent. In the interests of the comic muse and of truth, he would bring them to Windy Corner. Chapter 11. In Mrs. Vyse's Well-Appointed Flat. The comic muse, though able to look after her own interests, did not disdain the assistance of Mr. Vyse. His idea of bringing the Emersons to Windy Corner struck her as decidedly good, and she carried through the negotiations without a hitch. Sir Harry Otway signed the agreement, met Mr. Emerson, who was duly disillusioned. The Miss Allens were duly offended, and wrote a dignified letter to Lucy, whom they held responsible for the failure. Mr. Beebe planned pleasant moments for the newcomers, and told Mrs. Honeychurch that Freddy must call on them as soon as they arrived. Indeed, so ample was the Muse's equipment that she permitted Mr. Harris, never a very robust criminal, to droop his head, to be forgotten, and to die. Lucy, to descend from bright heaven to earth, whereon there are shadows because there are hills. Lucy was at first plunged into despair, but settled after a little thought that it did not matter the very least. Now that she was engaged, the Emersons would scarcely insult her, and were welcome into the neighbourhood. And Cecil was welcome to bring whom he would into the neighbourhood. Therefore Cecil was welcome to bring the Emersons into the neighbourhood. But, as I say, this took a little thinking, and, so illogical are girls, the event remained rather greater and rather more dreadful than it should have done. She was glad that a visit to Mrs. Vyse now fell due. The tenants moved into Cissy Villa while she was safe in the London flat.
"Cecil, Cecil, darling," she whispered the evening she arrived and crept into his arms.
Cecil, too, became demonstrative. He saw that the needful fire had been kindled in Lucy. At last she longed for attention, as a woman should, and looked up to him because he was a man.
"So you do love me, little thing," he murmured.
"Oh, Cecil, I do, I do. I don't know what I should do without you." Several days passed. Then she had a letter from Miss Bartlett. A coolness had sprung up between the two cousins, and they had not corresponded since they parted in August. The coolness dated from what Charlotte would call the flight to Rome, and in Rome it had increased amazingly. For the companion who is merely uncongenial in the medieval world becomes exasperating in the classical. Charlotte, unselfish in the forum, would have tried a sweeter temper than Lucy's, and once in the baths of Caracalla they had doubted whether they could continue their tour. Lucy had said she would join the Vyses. Mrs. Vyse was an acquaintance of her mother, so there was no impropriety in the plan, and Miss Bartlett had replied that she was quite used to being abandoned suddenly. Finally nothing happened, but the coolness remained, and for Lucy was even increased when she opened the letter and read as follows. It had been forwarded from Windy Corner. Tunbridge Wells, September.
Dearest Lucia, I have news of you at last,
Miss Lavish has been bicycling in your parts, but was not sure whether a call would be welcome. Puncturing her tyre near Summer Street, and it being mended, while she sat very woe-begone in that pretty churchyard, she saw, to her astonishment, a door open opposite, and the younger Emerson man come out. He said his father had just taken the house. He said he did not know that you lived in the neighbourhood. He never suggested giving Eleanor a cup of tea. Dear Lucy, I am much worried, and I advise you to make a clean breast of his past behaviour to your mother, Freddy and Mr. Vyse, who will forbid him to enter the house, etc. That was a great misfortune, and I dare say you have told them already. Mr. Vyse is so sensitive. I remember how I used to get on his nerves at Rome. I am very sorry about it all, and should not feel easy unless I warned you. Believe me, your anxious and loving cousin, Charlotte. Lucy was much annoyed, and replied as follows. Beecham Mansions, S.W. Dear Charlotte, many thanks for your warning. When Mr. Emerson forgot himself on the mountain, you made me promise not to tell Mother, because you said she would blame you for not being always with me. I have kept that promise, and cannot possibly tell her now. I have said both to her and Cecil that I met the Emersons at Florence, and that they are respectable people, which I do think, and the reason that he offered Miss Lavish no tea was probably that he had none himself. She should have tried at the rectory. I cannot begin making a fuss at this stage. You must see that it would be too absurd. If the Emersons heard I had complained of them, they would think themselves of importance, which is exactly what they are not. I like the old father, and look forward to seeing him again. As for the son, I am sorry for him when we meet rather than for myself. They are known to Cecil, who is very well and spoke of you the other day. We expect to be married in January. Miss Lavish cannot have told you much about me, for I am not at Windy Corner at all, but here. Please do not put private outside your envelope again. No one opens my letters. Yours affectionately, L. M. Honeychurch. Secrecy has this disadvantage. We lose the sense of proportion. We cannot tell whether our secret is important or not. Were Lucy and her cousin closeted with a great thing, which would destroy Cecil's life if he discovered it, or with a little thing which he would laugh at? Miss Bartlett suggested the former. Perhaps she was right. It had become a great thing now. Left to herself, Lucy would have told her mother, and her lover, ingenuously, and it would have remained a little thing. Emerson, not Harris. It was only that a few weeks ago. She tried to tell Cecil, even now, when they were laughing about some beautiful lady who had smitten his heart at school. But her body behaved so ridiculously that she stopped. She and her secret stayed 10 days longer in the deserted metropolis, visiting the scenes they were to know so well later on. It did her no harm, Cecil thought, to learn the framework of society, while society itself was absent on the golf links or the moors. The weather was cool, and it did her no harm. In spite of the season, Mrs. Vyse managed to scrape together a dinner party consisting entirely of the grandchildren of famous people. The food was poor, but the talk had a witty weariness that impressed the girl. One was tired of everything, it seemed. One launched into enthusiasms only to collapse gracefully and pick oneself up amid sympathetic laughter. In this atmosphere, the Pension Bertolini and Windy Corner appeared equally crude. And Lucy saw that her London career would estrange her a little from all that she had loved in the past. The grandchildren asked her to play the piano. She played Schumann. "Now some Beethoven," called Cecil, when the querulous beauty of the music had died. She shook her head and played Schumann again. The melody rose, unprofitably magical. It broke. It was resumed broken, not marching once from the cradle to the grave. The sadness of the incomplete, the sadness that is often life, but should never be art, throbbed in its disjected phrases, and made the nerves of the audience throb. Not thus had she played on the little draped piano at the Bertolini, and too much Schumann was not the remark that Mr. Beebe had passed to himself when she returned. When the guests were gone, and Lucy had gone to bed, Mrs. Vyse paced up and down the drawing-room discussing her little party with her son. Mrs. Vyse was a nice woman, but her personality, like many another's, had been swamped by London, for it needs a strong head to live among many people. The too vast orb of her fate had crushed her, and she had seen too many seasons, too many cities, too many men for her abilities, and even with Cecil she was mechanical, and behaved as if he was not one son, but, so to speak, a filial crowd.
"Make Lucy one of us," she said, looking round intelligently at the end of each sentence, and straining her lips apart until she spoke again. "Lucy is becoming wonderful, wonderful. Her music always was wonderful. Yes, but she's purging off the Honeychurch taint. Most excellent Honeychurches. But you know what I mean. She is not always quoting servants or asking one how the pudding is made. Italy has done it."
"Perhaps," she murmured, thinking of the museum that represented Italy to her.
"It is just possible. Cecil, mind you marry her next January. She is one of us already."
"But her music," he exclaimed, "the style of her, how she kept to Schumann when, like an idiot, I wanted Beethoven. Schumann was right for this evening. Schumann was the thing. Do you know, Mother, I shall have our children educated just like Lucy. Bring them up amongst honest country folks for freshness, send them to Italy for subtlety, and then, not till then, let them come to London. I don't believe in these London educations."
He broke off, remembering that he had had one himself, and concluded,
"At all events, not for women." "Make her one of us," repeated Mrs. Vyse, and processed to bed.
As she was dozing off, a cry, the cry of nightmare, rang from Lucy's room. Lucy could ring for the maid if she liked, but Mrs. Vyse thought it kind to go herself. She found the girl sitting upright with her hand on her cheek. "I'm so sorry, Mrs. Vyse. It is these dreams."
"Bad dreams?"
"Just dreams." The elder lady smiled and kissed her, saying very distinctly,
"You should have heard us talking about you, dear. He admires you more than ever. Dream of that."
Lucy returned the kiss, still covering one cheek with her hand. Mrs. Vyse recessed to bed. Cecil, whom the cry had not awoke, snored. Darkness enveloped the flat. Chapter 12. 12th Chapter. It was a Saturday afternoon, gay and brilliant after abundant rains, and the spirit of youth dwelt in it, though the season was now autumn. All that was gracious triumphed. As the motor cars passed through Summer Street, they raised only a little dust, and their stench was soon dispersed by the wind and replaced by the scent of the wet birches or the pines. Mr. Beebe, at leisure for life's amenities, leant over his rectory gate. Freddy leant by him, smoking a pendant pipe.
"Suppose we go and hinder those new people opposite for a little."
"Hmm? They might amuse you."
Freddy, whom his fellow creatures never amused, suggested that the new people might be feeling a bit busy, and so on, since they had only just moved in.
"I suggested we should hinder them," said Mr. Beebe. "They are worth it."
Unlatching the gate, he sauntered over the triangular green to Sissy Villa.
"Hello!"
he cried, shouting in at the open door, through which much squalor was visible. A grave voice replied,
"Hello! I've brought someone to see you. I'll be down in a minute."
The passage was blocked by a wardrobe, which the removal men had failed to carry up the stairs. Mr. Beebe edged round it with difficulty. The sitting room itself was blocked with books.
"Are these people great readers?" Freddy whispered. "Are they that sort?" "I fancy they know how to read. A rare accomplishment. What have they got? Byron? Exactly. A Shropshire lad. Never heard of it. The Way of All Flesh. Never heard of it. Gibbon. Hello. Dear George reads German. Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, and so we go on. Well, I suppose your generation knows its own business, Honeychurch.
Mr. Beebe, look at that, said Freddy in awestruck tones. On the cornice of the wardrobe, the hand of an amateur had painted this inscription. Mistrust all enterprises that require new clothes.
I know. Isn't it jolly? I like that. I'm certain that's the old man's doing.
How very odd of him.
Surely you agree.
But Freddy was his mother's son, and felt that one ought not to go on spoiling the furniture.
Pictures,
the clergyman continued, scrambling about the room.
Giotto! They got that at Florence, I'll be bound.
Same as Lucy's got.
Oh, by the by, did Miss Honeychurch enjoy London?
She came back yesterday.
I suppose she had a good time?
Yes, very, said Freddy, taking up a book. She and Cecil are thicker than ever.
That's good hearing.
I wish I wasn't such a fool, Mr. Beebe.
Mr. Beebe ignored the remark.
Lucy used to be nearly as stupid as I am, but it will be very different now, Mother thinks. She will read all kinds of books.
So will you.
Only medical books, not books that you can talk about afterwards. Cecil is teaching Lucy Italian, and he says her playing is wonderful. There are all kinds of things in it that we have never noticed.
Cecil says, what on earth are those people doing upstairs?
Emerson, we think we'll come another time.
George ran downstairs and pushed them into the room without speaking.
Let me introduce Mr. Honeychurch, a neighbour.
Then Freddy hurled one of the thunderbolts of youth. Perhaps he was shy, perhaps he was friendly, or perhaps he thought that George's face wanted washing. At all events, he greeted him with,
How d'ye do? Come and have a bathe.
Oh, all right, said George, impassive. Mr. Beebe was highly entertained.
How do you do? How do you do? Come and have a bathe, he chuckled. That's the best conversational opening I've ever heard. But I'm afraid it will only act between men. Can you picture a lady who has been introduced to another lady by a third lady opening civilities with, How do you do? Come and have a bathe. And yet you will tell me that the sexes are equal.
I tell you that they shall be, said Mr. Emerson, who had been slowly descending the stairs.
Good afternoon, Mr. Beebe. I tell you they shall be comrades. And George thinks the same.
We are to raise ladies to our level, the clergyman inquired.
The Garden of Eden, pursued Mr. Emerson, still descending, which you place in the past, is really yet to come. We shall enter it when we no longer despise our bodies. Mr. Beebe disclaimed placing the Garden of Eden anywhere.
In this, not in other things, we men are ahead. We despise the body less than women do, but not until we are comrades shall we enter the garden.
I say, what about this bathe?
Murmured Freddy, appalled at the mass of philosophy that was approaching him.
I believed in a return to nature once, but how can we return to nature when we have never been with her? Today, I believe that we must discover nature. After many conquests, we shall attain simplicity. It is our heritage.
Let me introduce Mr. Honeychurch, whose sister you will remember at Florence.
How do you do? Very glad to see you, and that you are taking George for a bathe. Very glad to hear that your sister is going to marry. Marriage is a duty. I am sure that she will be happy, for we know Mr. Vyse, too. He has been most kind. He met us by chance in the National Gallery and arranged everything about this delightful house. Though I hope I have not vexed Sir Harry Otway, I have met so few liberal landowners, and I was anxious to compare his attitude towards the game laws with the conservative attitude.
Ah, this wind! You do well to bathe.
Yours is a glorious country, Honeychurch.
Not a bit, mumbled Freddy. I must, that is to say, I have to have the pleasure of calling on you later on, my mother says, I hope.
Call, my lad? Who taught us that drawing-room twaddle? Call on your grandmother? Listen to the wind among the pines. Yours is a glorious country.
Mr. Beebe came to the rescue.
Mr. Emerson, he will call. I shall call. You or your son will return our calls before 10 days have elapsed. I trust that you have realized about the 10 days interval. It does not count that I helped you with the stare eyes yesterday. It does not count that they are going to bathe this afternoon.
Yes, go and bathe, George. Why do you dawdle talking? Bring him back to tea. Bring back some milk, cakes, honey. The change will do you good. George has been working very hard at his office. I can't believe he's well.
George bowed his head, dusty and somber, exhaling the peculiar smell of one who has handled furniture.
"Do you really want this bathe?" Freddy asked him. "It is only a pond, don't you know? I dare say you're used to something better."
"Yes, I have said yes already."
Mr. Beebe felt bound to assist his young friend, and led the way out of the house and into the pine woods. How glorious it was! For a little time the voice of old Mr. Emerson pursued them, dispensing good wishes and philosophy. It ceased, and they only heard the fair wind blowing the bracken and the trees. Mr. Beebe, who could be silent, but who could not bear silence, was compelled to chatter, since the expedition looked like a failure, and neither of his companions would utter a word. He spoke of Florence. George attended gravely, assenting or dissenting with slight but determined gestures that were as inexplicable as the motions of the treetops above their heads.
"And what a coincidence that you should meet Mr. Vyse! Did you realize that you would find all the Pension Bertolini down here?"
"I did not. Miss Lavish told me."
"When I was a young man, I always meant to write a history of coincidence."
No enthusiasm.
"Though, as a matter of fact, coincidences are much rarer than we suppose. For example, it isn't purely coincidentally that you are here now, when one comes to reflect."
To his relief, George began to talk.
"It is. I have reflected. It is fate. Everything is fate. We are flung together by fate, drawn apart by fate, flung together, drawn apart. The 12 winds blow us. We settle nothing." "You've not reflected at all," rapped the clergyman. "Let me give you a useful tip. Emerson, attribute nothing to fate. Don't say, 'I didn't do this, for you did it,' 10 to 1. Now I'll cross-question you. Where did you first meet Miss Honeychurch and myself?"
"Italy."
"And where did you meet Mr. Vyse, who was going to marry Miss Honeychurch?"
"National Gallery."
"Looking at Italian art. There you are. And yet you talk of coincidence and fate. You naturally seek out things Italian, and so do we, and our friends. This narrows the field immeasurably. We meet again in it."
"It is fate that I am here," persisted George. "But you can call it Italy if it makes you less unhappy." Mr. Beebe slid away from such heavy treatment of the subject. But he was infinitely tolerant of the young, and had no desire to snub George.
"And so for this, and for other reasons, my history of coincidence is still to write."
Silence.
Wishing to round off the episode, he added,
"We are all so glad that you have come."
Silence.
"Here we are," called Freddy.
"Oh, good," exclaimed Mr. Beebe, mopping his brow. "In there's the pond. I wish it was bigger," he added apologetically.
They climbed down a slippery bank of pine needles. There lay the pond, set in its little alp of green. Only a pond, but large enough to contain the human body, and pure enough to reflect the sky. On account of the rains, the waters had flooded the surrounding grass, which showed like a beautiful emerald path, tempting these feet towards the central pool. "'It's distinctly successful, as ponds go,' said Mr. Beebe. "'No apologies are necessary for the pond.' George sat down where the ground was dry and drearily unlaced his boots. "'Aren't those masses of willow herb splendid? I love willow herb and seed. What's the name of this aromatic plant?'
No one knew or seemed to care.
"'These abrupt changes of vegetation, this little spongious tract of water plants, and on either side of it all the growths are tough or brittle, heather, bracken, hertz, pines. Very charming, very charming.'
"'Mr. Beebe, aren't you bathing?'
called Freddy as he stripped himself. Mr. Beebe thought he was not.
"'Water's wonderful!' cried Freddy, prancing in.
"'Water's water,' murmured George. Wetting his hair first, a sure sign of apathy, he followed Freddy into the divine, as indifferent as if he were a statue and the pond a pail of soapsuds. It was necessary to use his muscles. It was necessary to keep clean. Mr. Beebe watched them, and watched the seeds of the willow herb dance chorically above their heads.
"'Apish! Apish! Apish!'
went Freddy, swimming for two strokes in either direction, and then becoming involved in reeds or mud.
"'Is it worth it?'
asked the other, Michelangelesque, on the flooded margin. The bank broke away, and he fell into the pool before he had weighed the question properly.
"'Hee, poof, I've swallowed a pollywog, Mr. Beebe. Water's wonderful. Water's simply ripping.'
"'Water's not so bad,' said George, reappearing from his plunge and sputtering at the sun.
"'Water's wonderful, Mr. Beebe. Do. Apershu, poof.'
Mr. Beebe, who was hot and who always acquiesced where possible, looked around him. He could detect no parishioners except the pine trees, rising up steeply on all sides and gesturing to each other against the blue. How glorious it was! The world of motor cars and rural deans receded inimitably. Water, sky, evergreens, a wind, these things not even the seasons can touch, and surely they lie beyond the intrusion of man.
"'I may as well wash too.'
And soon his garments had made a third little pile on the sward, and he too asserted the wonder of the water. It was ordinary water, nor was there very much of it, and, as Freddy said, it reminded one of swimming in a salad. The three gentlemen rotated in the pool breast high, after the fashion of the nymphs in Gotterdammerung. But either because the rains had given a freshness, or because the sun was shedding a most glorious heat, or because two of the gentlemen were young in years, and the third young in spirit, for some reason or other a change came over them, and they forgot Italy and botany and fate. They began to play. Mr. Beebe and Freddy splashed each other. A little deferentially, they splashed George. He was quiet. They feared they had offended him. Then all the forces of youth burst out. He smiled, flung himself at them, splashed them, ducked them, kicked them, muddied them, and drove them out of the pool.
"'Race you round it, then!'
cried Freddy, and they raced in the sunshine. And George took a short cut and dirtied his shins, and had to bathe a second time. Then Mr. Beebe consented to run. A memorable sight. They ran to get dry. They bathed to get cool. They played at being Indians in the willow herbs and in the bracken. They bathed to get clean. And all the time three little bundles lay discreetly on the sward, proclaiming, "No, we are what matters. Without us shall no enterprise begin. To us shall all flesh turn in the end."
"A try! A try!"
yelled Freddy, snatching up George's bundle and placing it beside an imaginary goalpost.
"Soccer rules," George retorted, scattering Freddy's bundle with a kick. "Goal! Goal! Pass!" "Take care, my watch," cried Mr. Beebe.
Clothes flew in all directions.
"Take care, my hat. No, that's enough, Freddy. Dress now. No, I say." But the two young men were delirious. Away they twinkled into the trees, Freddy with a clerical waistcoat under his arm, George with a wide-awake hat on his dripping hair.
"That'll do," shouted Mr. Beebe, remembering that after all he was in his own parish.
Then his voice changed, as if every pine tree was a rural dean.
"Ha! Steady on! I see people coming, you fellows!"
Yells and widening circles over the dappled earth.
"Hi! Hi! Ladies!"
Neither George nor Freddy was truly refined. Still, they did not hear Mr. Beebe's last warning, or they would have avoided Mrs. Honeychurch, Cecil, and Lucy, who were walking down to call on old Mrs. Butterworth. Freddy dropped the waistcoat at their feet and dashed into some bracken. George whooped in their faces, turned and scudded away down the path to the pond, still clad in Mr. Beebe's hat.
"Gracious alive!" cried Mrs. Honeychurch. "Whoever were those unfortunate people? Oh, dears, look away! And poor Mr. Beebe, too! Whatever has happened?"
"Come this way immediately," commanded Cecil, who always felt that he must lead women, though knew not whither, and protect them, though he knew not against what. He led them now towards the bracken, where Freddy sat concealed.
"Oh, poor Mr. Beebe! Was that his waistcoat we left in the path? Cecil, Mr. Beebe's waistcoat!"
"No business of ours," said Cecil, glancing at Lucy, who was all parasol and evidently minded.
"I fancy Mr. Beebe jumped back into the pond."
"This way, please, Mrs. Honeychurch, this way."
They followed him up the bank, attempting the tense, yet nonchalant, expression that is suitable for ladies on such occasions.
"Well, I can't help it," said a voice close ahead,
and Freddy reared a freckled face and a pair of snowy shoulders out of the fronds.
"I can't be trodden on, can I?"
"Good gracious me, dear, so it's you! What miserable management! Why not have a comfortable bath at home, with hot and cold laid on?"
"Look here, Mother, a fellow must wash, and a fellow's got to dry, and if another fellow..."
"Dear, no doubt you're right, as usual, but you are in no position to argue."
"Come, Lucy." They turned.
"Oh, look! Don't look! Oh, poor Mr. Beebe! How unfortunate again!"
For Mr. Beebe was just crawling out of the pond, on whose surface garments of an intimate nature did float, while George, the world-weary George, shouted to Freddy that he had hooked a fish.
"And me, I've swallowed one," answered he of the bracken. "I've swallowed a pollywog. It wriggleth in my tummy. I shall die. Emerson, you beast, you've got on my bags."
"Hush, dears," said Mrs. Honeychurch, who found it impossible to remain shocked. "And do be sure you dry yourselves thoroughly first. All these colds come of not drying thoroughly."
"Mother, do come away," said Lucy. "Oh, for goodness sake, do come."
"Hullo," cried George, so that again the ladies stopped.
He regarded himself as dressed, barefoot, bare-chested, radiant and personable against the shadowy woods. He called,
"Hullo, Miss Honeychurch! Hullo!"
"Bow, Lucy, better bow. Whoever is it, I shall bow."
Miss Honeychurch bowed. That evening, and all that night, the water ran away. On the morrow the pool had shrunk to its old size and lost its glory. It had been a call to the blood and to the relaxed will, a passing benediction whose influence did not pass, a holiness, a spell, a momentary chalice for youth.
Chapter 13. How Miss Bartlett's boiler was so tiresome. How often had Lucy rehearsed this bow, this interview? But she had always rehearsed them indoors, and with certain accessories, which surely we have a right to assume. Who could foretell that she and George would meet in the rout of a civilization, amidst an army of coats and collars and boots that lay wounded over the sunlit earth? She had imagined a young Mr. Emerson who might be shy, or morbid, or indifferent, or furtively impudent. She was prepared for all of these. but she had never imagined one who would be happy and greet her with the shout of the morning star. Indoors herself, partaking of tea with old Mrs. Butterworth, she reflected that it is impossible to foretell the future with any degree of accuracy, that it is impossible to rehearse life. A fault in the scenery, a face in the audience, an eruption of the audience onto the stage, and all our carefully planned gestures mean nothing, or mean too much. "I will bow," she had thought. "I will not shake hands with him. That will be just the proper thing." She had bowed. But to whom? To gods? To heroes? To the nonsense of schoolgirls? She had bowed across the rubbish that cumbers the world. So ran her thoughts, while her faculties were busy with Cecil. It was another of those dreadful engagement calls. Mrs. Butterworth had wanted to see him, and he did not want to be seen. He did not want to hear about hydrangeas, why they changed their colour at the seaside. He did not want to join the COS. When cross, he was always elaborate, and made long, clever answers, where yes or no would have done. Lucy soothed him and tinkered at the conversation in a way that promised well for their married peace. No one is perfect, and surely it is wiser to discover the imperfections before wedlock. Miss Bartlett, indeed, though not in word, had taught the girl that this, our life, contains nothing satisfactory. Lucy, though she disliked the teacher, regarded the teaching as profound, and applied it to her lover. "Lucy," said her mother when they got home, "is anything the matter with Cecil?" The question was ominous. Up till now, Mrs. Honeychurch had behaved with charity and restraint. "No, I don't think so, Mother. Cecil's all right." "Perhaps he's tired," Lucy compromised. Perhaps Cecil was a little tired. "Because otherwise," she pulled out her bonnet pins with gathering displeasure, "because otherwise, I cannot account for him. I do think Mrs. Butterworth is rather tiresome, if you mean that." "Cecil has told you to think so. You were devoted to her as a little girl, and nothing will describe her goodness to you through the typhoid fever. No, 'tis just the same thing everywhere. Let me just put your bonnet away, may I? Surely you could answer her civilly for one half hour." "Cecil has a very high standard for people," faltered Lucy, seeing trouble ahead. "It's part of his ideals. It is really that that makes him sometimes seem..." "Oh, rubbish! If high ideals make a young man rude, the sooner he gets rid of them the better," said Mrs. Honeychurch, handing her the bonnet. "Now, Mother, I've seen you cross with Mrs. Butterworth yourself." "Not in that way. At times I could wring her neck, but not in that way. No, it is the same with Cecil all over. By the by, I never told you. I had a letter from Charlotte while I was away in London." This attempt to divert the conversation was too puerile, and Mrs. Honeychurch resented it. "Since Cecil came back from London, nothing appears to please him. Whenever I speak, he winces. I see him, Lucy. It is useless to contradict me. No doubt I am neither artistic, nor literary, nor intellectual, nor musical, but I cannot help the drawing-room furniture. Your father bought it, and we must put up with it. Will Cecil kindly remember?"
I see what you mean, and certainly Cecil oughtn't to. But he does not mean to be uncivil. He once explained, it is the things that upset him. He is easily upset by ugly things. He is not uncivil to people. Is it a thing or a person when Freddy sings? Well, you can't expect a really musical person to enjoy comic songs as we do. Then why didn't he leave the room? Why sit wriggling and sneering and spoiling everyone's pleasure?
We mustn't be unjust to people, faltered Lucy. Something had enfeebled her, and the case for Cecil, which she had mastered so perfectly in London, would not come forth in an effective form. The two civilizations had clashed. Cecil hinted that they might,
and she was dazzled and bewildered, as though the radiance that lies behind all civilization had blinded her eyes. Good taste and bad taste were only catchwords, garments of diverse cut, and music itself dissolved to a whisper through pine trees, where the song is not distinguishable from the comic song. She remained in much embarrassment while Mrs. Honeychurch changed her frock for dinner, and every now and then she said a word and made things no better. There was no concealing the fact. Cecil had meant to be supercilious, and he had succeeded. And Lucy, she knew not why, wished that the trouble could have come at any other time. "Go and dress, dear. You'll be late." "All right, Mother." "Don't say all right and stop. Go." She obeyed, but loitered disconsolately at the landing window. It faced north, so there was little view, and no view of the sky. Now, as in the winter, the pine trees hung close to her eyes. One connected the landing window with depression. No definite problem menaced her, but she sighed to herself. "Oh, dear, what shall I do? What shall I do?" It seemed to her that everyone else was behaving very badly, and she ought not to have mentioned Miss Bartlett's letter. She must be more careful. Her mother was rather inquisitive, and might have asked what it was about. Oh, dear, should she do? And then Freddy came bounding upstairs and joined the ranks of the ill-behaved.
"I say, those are topping people."
"My dear baby, how tiresome you've been. You have no business to take them bathing in the sacred. It's much too public. It was all right for you, but most awkward for everyone else. Do be more careful. You forget the place is growing half suburban.
I say, is anything on tomorrow week?"
"Not that I know of."
"Then I want to ask the Emersons up to Sunday tennis."
"Oh, I wouldn't do that, Freddy. I wouldn't do that with all this muddle."
"What's wrong with the court? They won't mind a bump or two, and I've ordered new balls."
"I meant it's better not. I really mean it." He seized her by the elbows and humorously danced her up and down the passage. She pretended not to mind, but she could have screamed with temper. Cecil glanced at them as he proceeded to his toilet, and they impeded Mary with her brood of hot water cans. Then Mrs. Honeychurch opened her door and said, "Lucy, what a noise you're making! I have something to say to you. Did you say you had a letter from Charlotte?" And Freddy ran away. "Yes, I really can't stop. I must dress too." "Well, how is Charlotte?" "All right. Lucy!" The unfortunate girl returned. "You've a bad habit of hurrying away in the middle of one's sentences. Did Charlotte mention her boiler?"
"Her what?"
"Don't you remember that her boiler was to be had out in October and her bath system cleaned out, and all kinds of terrible to-doings?"
"I can't remember all Charlotte's worries," said Lucy bitterly. "I shall have enough of my own, now that you are not pleased with Cecil."
Mrs. Honeychurch might have flamed out. She did not. She said, "Come here, old lady. Thank you for putting away my bonnet. Kiss me." And, though nothing is perfect, Lucy felt for the moment that her mother and Windy Corner and the Weald in the declining sun were perfect. So the grittiness went out of life. It generally did at Windy Corner. At the last minute, when the social machine was clogged hopelessly, one member or other of the family poured in a drop of oil. Cecil despised their methods, perhaps rightly. At all events, they were not his own. Dinner was at 7:30. Freddy gabbled the grace, and they drew up their heavy chairs and fell to. Fortunately, the men were hungry. Nothing untoward occurred until the pudding. Then Freddy said,
"Lucy, what's Emerson like?"
"I saw him in Florence," said Lucy, hoping that this would pass for a reply.
"Is he the clever sort, or is he a decent chap?"
"Ask Cecil. It is Cecil who brought him here."
"He is the clever sort, like myself," said Cecil.
Freddy looked at him doubtfully.
"How well did you know them at the Bertolini?" asked Mrs. Honeychurch.
"Oh, very slightly. I mean, Charlotte knew them even less than I did. Oh, that reminds me. You never told me what Charlotte said in her letter. One thing and another, said Lucy, wondering whether she would get through the meal without a lie. Among other things, that an awful friend of hers had been bicycling through Summer Street. Wondered if she'd come up and see us, and mercifully didn't.
Lucy, I do call the way you talk unkind.
She was a novelist, said Lucy craftily. The remark was a happy one, for nothing roused Mrs. Honeychurch so much as literature in the hands of females. She would abandon every topic to inveigh against those women who, instead of minding their houses and their children, seek notoriety by print. Her attitude was, if books must be written, let them be written by men. And she developed it at great length, while Cecil yawned and Freddy played at this year, next year, now, never, with his plumstones, and Lucy artfully fed the flames of her mother's wrath. But soon the conflagration died down, and the ghosts began to gather in the darkness. There were too many ghosts about. The original ghost, that touch of lips on her cheek, had surely been laid long ago. It could be nothing to her that a man had kissed her on a mountain once, but it had begotten a spectral family, Mr. Harris, Miss Bartlett's letter, Mr. Beebe's memories of violets, and one or other of these was bound to haunt her before Cecil's very eyes. It was Miss Bartlett who returned now, and with appalling vividness. "I have been thinking, Lucy, of that letter of Charlotte's. How is she?" "I tore the thing up." "Well, didn't she say how she was? How does she sound? Cheerful?" "Oh, yes, I suppose so. No, not very cheerful, I suppose." "Then depend upon it. It is the boiler. I know myself how water preys upon one's mind. I would rather anything else, even a misfortune with the meat." Cecil laid his hand over his eyes.
"So would I," asserted Freddy, backing his mother up, backing up the spirit of her remark rather than the substance.
"And I have been thinking," she added rather nervously, "surely we could squeeze Charlotte in here next week and give her a nice holiday while plumbers at Tunbridge Wells finish. I have not seen poor Charlotte for so long." It was more than her nerves could stand, and she could not protest violently after her mother's goodness to her upstairs. "Mother, no," she pleaded. "It's impossible. We can't have Charlotte. On the top of the other things, we're squeezed to death as it is. Freddy's got a friend coming Tuesday. There's Cecil. And you've promised to take in Minnie Beebe because of the diphtheria scare. It simply can't be done." "Nonsense. It can. If Minnie sleeps in the bath, not otherwise."
"Minnie can sleep with you."
"I won't have her." "Then, if you're so selfish, Mr. Floyd must share a room with Freddy."
"Miss Bartlett, Miss Bartlett, Miss Bartlett," moaned Cecil, again laying his hand over his eyes.
"It's impossible," repeated Lucy. "I don't want to make difficulties, but it really isn't fair on the maids to fill up the house so."
"Alas. The truth is, dear, you don't like Charlotte."
"No, I don't. And no more does Cecil. She gets on our nerves. You haven't seen her lately and don't realize how tiresome she can be, though so good.
So please, Mother, don't worry us this last summer, but spoil us by not asking her to come."
"Hear, hear," said Cecil.
Mrs. Honeychurch, with more gravity than usual, and with more feeling than she usually permitted herself, replied, "This isn't very kind of you two. You have each other and all these woods to walk in, so full of beautiful things, and poor Charlotte has only the water turned off, and plumbers. You are young, dears, and however clever young people are, and however many books they read, they will never guess what it feels like to grow old." Cecil crumbled his bread.
"I must say Cousin Charlotte was very kind to me that year I called on my bike," put in Freddy. "She thanked me for coming till I felt like such a fool, and fussed round no end to get an egg boiled for my tea just right."
"I know, dear. She is kind to everyone, and yet Lucy makes this difficulty when we try to give her some little return." But Lucy hardened her heart.
It was no good being kind to Miss Bartlett. She had tried herself too often and too recently. One might lay up treasure in heaven by the attempt, but one enriched neither Miss Bartlett